Welcome to Activate Yourself with Gita Sidhu-Rab, where we feature otherwise normal people who, because of events in their life, have turned left and done unusual, inspiring, incredible things, like build a business, become a happiness expert, marry a prince, create an empire, or like your host, set up a health and wellness business, Nosh Detox. Here's your host, Gita Sidhu-Rab.
Hi, my name is Gita Sidhu-Rab, and this is Activate Yourself. And, you know, I did a TED Talk recently, and in my TED Talk, I said that it's funny the things that you say that catch people's attention, and this one statistic has led to me hearing more interesting stories than anything I think I've ever said. And if you know me, I've said a lot. And I said that crash test dummies for men were invented in 1996. And I always ask people, do you know when crash test dummies for women were invented? And no one knows, because it was last year, 2025. What's really ironic about this is that today's guest started doing what she's doing because of a car crash and these non-female crash test dummies. So please welcome a really, really somebody I admire and I respect. She's a client, she's a friend. And she runs a really interesting business where she just changes people's hearts and minds in really, really calm, authoritative, structured ways. And there's no gainsaying. Welcome to Sharon Pete.
Thank you, Gita. It's lovely to be here with you today.
So you have your car crash story, right? I mean, and please tell me, because I've only heard a little bit of it.
I do indeed. So when I was 23, I had a car accident driving home. I was a block from home. Apparently, there's some random statistic that disproportionate number of car accidents happen within a block from being home. Don't know why that is, but I was almost home. Yeah. And it was a relatively minor accident. Someone turned right in front of me, but misjudged and kind of collided with my car. I woke up some minutes later, the car was facing the other way. Done a 180 degree spin. I was right next to a power pole. There was a crowd of people around me. So I blacked out for a little while. Ended up in hospital with some internal injuries. So ended up with a ruptured bowel, broken cheekbone, broken nose, fractured vertebrae. So it was a smallish accident, but it had disproportionate injuries. And so I was off in hospital for a month. I was off work for 3 months. Took a long time to get my full strength back. Yeah, yeah. And the reason this is an origin story for the work I do in gender equity is that years later, and I had no idea about this at the time, but years later, I realized that the reason I had the internal injury was the impact of the lower half of the seatbelt. So on a woman, it sits above the hips, the lower part of the seatbelt, whereas on a man, it's designed to sit below the hips. So above the hips, it's kind of where your organs are. And the impact of the seatbelt doing its job and invariably saving my life was that it cut really hard across my abdomen and caused this internal injury, which wasn't originally picked up. It took a couple of days. I had, you know, ruptured bowel, which was leaking into my bloodstream. It wasn't until I got septicemia that they realized that something was going on. There was an internal injury. So I came very close to actually losing my life because of the seatbelt.
Blimey. You know, these stories, like when I did the TED Talk, which happened completely by accident, I wasn't intending to do it. And they gave me like 10 days to put it together. I went down the rabbit hole of trying to understand how different women's and men's lives are, because I've always made a joke about this. And I'm like, if you say something's normal, I say it's white man. And if you say it's traditional, I'll say it's rich white man. But you don't understand that until you really listen to stories like this, or the Ambien story, where they gave Ambien to women in a smaller dose than a man's dose because they never tested it on women. And the only way they found it was the wrong dosage is women were falling asleep at the wheel and crashing. And then they thought, and you're just like, it is utterly wild that we are quoted all these things and none of them have anything to do with our realities. Now, when people say, well, this is what you should do, I look at them and I'm thinking, how would you know that? Like, literally, how would you know that? Because I'd like to know what you have as proof. But for you, well, firstly, there was one piece of good news because you avoided a much worse calamity. And then secondly, you made it into something that turned good for lots of people, right?
Yeah. So I often say that car accident was the luckiest day of my life. And it didn't feel so lucky at the time. I was badly injured and I was in a lot of pain and so forth. But that accident happened on a Tuesday. And on the Saturday, my partner and I were due to take an internal holiday. So I was living in Australia at the time. We were due to fly to the island state of Tasmania for a weekend away. It had been planned for a very, very long time. And so in the first day or two in hospital, before they realized I had this internal injury, I said, am I still going to be okay to go to Tasmania and do this trip? And they said, oh, I'm not sure. We'll see. And then by the Thursday or the Friday, I had major surgery. They actually didn't know what was causing all my pain. They didn't know what was going on. So I had got a 25-centimeter scar on my stomach from where they just opened me up to just have a look around and see what was going on, which is when they noticed the ruptured intestine. So I was clearly, after major surgery, not in a position to go traveling the next day, which was just as well, because that weekend there was the worst ever mass shooting in Australia's history that took place at the place I would have been. So I woke up and you're stuck in a hospital. There's nothing to do. I was bed bound. I just had major surgery. I couldn't physically get out of bed. All I had was the TV. This is well before mobile phones and smartphones and iPads. All I had was the TV, and it was 24/7 news on the TV. And I just sat there by myself thinking, oh my goodness, did I really just avoid that? Wow.
That, by the grace of God, go I, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's very true. It's very true. And 9/11 had so many stories like that as well of people just, this didn't work and that didn't work. And yeah, no, absolutely. So talk about what it is that you do now as a result of that.
So I run a gender equity consulting firm called Shape Talent. We work with large organizations, typically multinationals around the world. And our vision is to live in a world where we have gender balance in leadership and to achieve that within our lifetime, not the 4 or 5 generations away that the UN are predicting it's going to take to get there. So we work with organizations to do a whole range of things, from diagnosing what are the challenges that are getting in the way of gender balance in the workplace through to women's development and acceleration programs. And the car accident, I guess, in many, many ways was part of my origin story. I didn't realize it at the time because it was many, many years later that I realized the seatbelt issue and the gendered nature of seatbelt design. When I read Caroline Criado Perez's book, Invisible Women, that's when I first came across that data.
Oh, so that was really, that's only 6 years ago.
Yeah. So that kind of, that helped make sense of it. There was another incident that happened at work, far more benign, less interesting story, where my boss at the time, I was kind of mid-career, in my 30s at this point, my boss gave me a project to do around gender equality. And I remember being I was in a senior HR role, and I remember being kind of a little bit kind of miffed by this because I thought it was a peripheral issue. I did not see that gender equity was a problem in workplaces. I ran the talent management team. I oversaw recruitment. I oversaw succession. I saw no evidence of bias in the processes. I managed the processes. There was no bias as far as I was concerned. And so I was a high potential early in my career. My career was going places. I didn't have problems, so I didn't really understand that other women did. And I took on this project, and we looked at data across the global organization. We looked at recruitment. We looked at performance data. We looked at remuneration, bonuses, salary increases, all of that. And suddenly I saw there were systemic differences in the rate at which women were promoted. They didn't get promoted as much. The salary reviews weren't as good. The performance rate weren't as good. And it wasn't just one or two locations or business units. It was around the world happening systemically. And when I saw that, I could not unsee that. And I just thought, wow, just because I seem to be getting ahead and not having a problem, it doesn't mean that there's not a problem. And that changed so much for me. Once I saw that data, I made it my mission to figure out what was really going on. Why was this happening in an organization that I couldn't see was overtly or deliberately biased in any way?
So let me stop you there for a minute, because that happens so much. You know, when you talk to people and explain this to them, the first thing they'll point out the women that have succeeded and gone, well, it's obviously true because look, and you're thinking, you know, like it's like when I say to people, oh yeah, but they're just a bit racist. And people will be like, but they can't be racist. There's a brown person. And you're like, yeah, no, no. No, you know, there's a non-threatening, non-competitive, non-everything brand person, which is a very different place to being a brand person that actually feels like you're going to get threatened there because they could be too intelligent or too whatever. That's a very different place to be, right? So what made you, what did you understand and learn and find out?
So it ultimately led me to setting up the business that I run now. So not straight away. I then spent probably another 6 or 7 years working in big corporates in HR, starting to bring this lens across everything that I did until ultimately I left the corporate world as an employee and started my own consultancy. We have done research several years running now on the barriers that get in the way of women's equal representation, and we've identified 17 barriers.
Wild.
They break down into three kind of super categories. Organizational barriers, which is the biggest one. There's 10 of the 17 barriers fall into that category. So this is the barriers in the workplace, the hurdles that women experience. So it could be structural or systemic, like lack of access to the right networks and sponsors. It could be lack of getting the right critical experiences, which are the building blocks of careers. Or it could be cultural. It could be this always-on culture that we see in organizations, the 24/7 mentality. So there's the organizational barriers. You've then got societal barriers. So these are the structural norms and cues that we all pick up over the course of our childhood and lifetime that reinforce gender stereotypes and the role of different genders in society. So gender stereotypes and the role of a mother and the role of a woman in the home is a big part of that. And then the third category is personal barriers. So you've got the organizational, societal, and personal barriers. And this is how women internalize a lot of these organizational and societal barriers and the impact that has. So whether women put themselves forward for promotions or opportunities, whether women negotiate in the home around the distribution of unpaid domestic work, care work, housework, all of these things influence how we show up and the results that we get. So we've identified these three barriers, and our work is all about dismantling them, particularly the structural barriers, because very few of the barriers are about women ourselves and what we do and how we show up. Most of the barriers are about the systems and the society in which we live.
I love that. I do think we're going to go for a quick break and then come back. And then I want to keep talking about this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so we're back. When you look at these systemic barriers, do you ever just get cross? How do you manage the unfairness of it?
That's a great question. I think I used to in the early days. I used to get really angry and annoyed. I guess my perspective now is that in order to change a system, in order to change a person, you've got to meet that person, that system, where it's at. There's anger can inspire and motivate you. Passion can inspire and motivate you, but it's not enough. You've got to meet the person or the system where they're at in order to facilitate change. So there's probably nothing I haven't heard before in a presentation, in a keynote, in conversations with skeptics. There's probably nothing that I haven't heard from, well, women don't want it, they're not interested, they're not as ambitious, to the really kind of offended people who will cross their arms at you in a conference and say, don't you believe in meritocracy and why are you pushing for more women?
If only they were good enough, they'd be fine.
Exactly. If only they were good enough, they would get the jobs, you know, that kind of mentality. So there's nothing that I haven't heard or seen. And the reality is that if you want to change people like that, you don't go in with an angry response because it gets you nowhere. You've got to understand where they're coming from. And the reality is society is getting really fatigued with the topic of gender equality. There's, you know, a lot of research that Ipsos have been doing over the last few years in conjunction with King's College London, where they survey, I think, 30 countries around the world, and people are tired of this. They think that we've achieved gender equality. They think in some cases it's gone too far. They think that men are being discriminated against now. So if you don't listen to that resistance, then actually you've got no hope of influencing people.
So I understand that. And I understand the concept of meeting people where they are. But when you look at the rank, and I say this because I obviously with W Corp, I work around a lot of this arena and people ask me this question. And that's why I'm interested in asking you. But when you can see how little has actually changed in the life of a woman, right, then how can you, do you just kind of put your head down and just keep going? Personally, how do you cope?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have my moments where
Yeah, especially also when you look at the DEI backlash,
yeah,
right, which is in itself very American driven, but how do you cope?
The DEI backlash that we started to see at the beginning of 2025, I mean, it'd be brewing for a few years, but it was really catalyzed by Donald Trump's executive orders in January last year. That did make me very angry for a bit. There's no value to be gained by sharing that publicly, I think. But personally, I was irritated because it was we're seeing an erosion of gains, hard-earned gains.
So fast. You're like, it's taken 20 years to get here and it's taken 1 year to lose it.
Yeah. And what we do know, and there have been lots of studies from the World Economic Forum is probably the most robust on this, that every year they do the Global Gender Gap Report. We are back at pre-COVID levels in terms of gender equality gains. So we'd kind of been making progress up to kind of a few years ago, you know, 2019. And COVID hit and we regressed. So we went from 99 years to gender parity to like 136 at one point. You know, we'd added a whole.
Yeah, I think we're now at 300, somebody said recently.
Well, it depends what you're measuring. There's right. Kind of different figures. But if you look at the World Economic Forum, I think it's 123 years in their latest report. And the UN talk about 140 years to get gender balance in leadership. So gender parity at leadership or managerial roles. So it depends what you measure. The World Economic Forum measures health outcomes, political outcomes, education and labor force participation. So it was a much broader index. But whatever measure you use, whatever way you look at it, we're stagnating or perhaps going backwards. And that's really tough. But having said that, if we don't have hope and a sincere belief that we can change this, then it does feel a bit pointless and overwhelming. So you know, the work continues. To me, it's just a reminder of why this work is important, why we need to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, because talking to you about purpose-driven companies and the thing I like about you is that you have such clarity about your impetus and your push and, you know, that you sort of take your passion and your purpose and give it a lot of scaffolding underneath it based on logic and numbers and statistics and reality. And you have always kind of said, you know, a purpose-driven business is what you run. And the purpose doesn't necessarily change. Is there a better way that we could be doing this? Because to me, if you are going to create a structural shift, then those shifts can never be taken back.
Mm.
You know? So like this whole work from home thing, for example, which changed the lives of women across the whole world, literally, it made such a big difference for us. And I started working from home when my kids were very, very young. I mean, 25 years ago, because I had a very ill child and I couldn't work from anywhere but home. And I remember the absolute offensiveness that I received as a result of working from home, because I was a lawyer and my lawyers don't work from home. And it was like, just, you can't be a very good lawyer, can you? And I remember thinking, well, I can't do that for a living. I had spent years studying to be a lawyer. I was a very good lawyer and I didn't like it at all, to be fair. But it was a way to make money. And I changed what I was doing for a living because I couldn't work from home. And so when you look at that, now there's a whole battle against work from home. And actually, it's not being run by people who want you to go back to the office. It's been run by landlords who have empty offices, which cost trillions to them and the banks, who then won't make loans on these. And you don't understand that until you look at the economic case against working from home, right? Because the money goes from commercial buildings into kind of, what do you call it, retail property market, and they're very against it.
Yeah. So, I don't know where to start in all of that. So working from home, remote working is a particular passion of mine because it is one of the real barriers for women, and not just women, but any minoritized groups in the workplace. So research study after research study shows that flexible working benefits those who are the most minoritized. So particularly given women carry the lion's share of the domestic load in the household, in heterosexual relationships at least, they're doing more of the housework, more of the unpaid caring work. So having more flexibility to fit all of that in by working from home, by working in a hybrid way is really, really important. So there is a very, very strong case for the value in terms of employee satisfaction and retention, but also productivity in remote work. But I absolutely agree. I think the push to get back in the office is being driven by a lot of commercial real estate firms. I mean, or companies who have these very long-term 10, 20-year leases that they have to feel they're getting some return on by having people in the office. So I think the future of work has to find a way of reconciling hybrid working. I've heard lots of arguments about, you know, you need to be in the office to build culture. I reject that entirely.
Oh my God, tell me more. I love it.
I mean,
number of times I hear that.
It is, I just think it's the biggest fallacy of all, and it is perpetuated by smart, sensible people. I am on a mission to run my business in a different way, to show that this doesn't need to be the case at all. And admittedly, my business isn't a multinational. I don't have 20,000 employees. I have a more modest team size. But we are fully remote. We've been set up fully remote from day one. It gives me many, many benefits.
I have a question. And when you said that, I have a client who asked me, how do I get my office in Spain to have the same message as my office in Japan, right? Isn't that the same thing as what you're talking about here when you've created a fully remote team, but everyone still needs to be connected?
Yeah. So we have a charter that we have agreed as a team as to how we will work together, culture canvas. So we have agreed that in order to stay connected, in order for relationships to be more than just superficial Zoom relationships, we need to meet in person a certain number of times in a year. So everyone is recruited with this in mind. Doesn't matter where you live. We've got people from the breadth of the country, from way up north to way down south. We have a commitment that we will meet in person at least four times a year for a day. One of those is often an extended period for a couple of days. So we have time together. In addition, we have certain routines that help to build our culture and connections. So we have a monthly team meeting. We have a weekly check-in that help us stay connected. Part of our ritual and our routines is to do a personal and a professional check-in at the beginning of those meetings. So one thing personal, one thing professional that's going on for you, quick round the table, and we find out what's going on for people. We find out how they are. We learn things about each other. So before we get straight into work, we've got some connection. We prioritize that. We also have really good disciplines in terms of our priorities and goal setting. So the times that we meet in person are to do goal setting and then quarterly goal reviews. So everyone is on the same page with what we're doing, what we're focusing on. We reiterate those messages in the monthly team meetings and our weekly check-ins so that everyone is connected and they know what the priorities are. So no one's feeling like they're off on an island, creating their own culture, doing their own thing. So I do think it's possible to maintain the culture that you want, but you've got to design for it. You've got to have some guardrails to make sure that happens, because it won't happen by accident. You've got to do it deliberately.
No, that's so good. Let's just quickly go on a break and come back and actually talk more about this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So we're back. So is that how, because there's always, somehow that story sticks in my mind where the prêt-à-manger person filling the shelves should know what to say about the food in the same way the person in Pret's executive office should know. How do they translate that?
So we do that, I think, largely through a goal setting and goal review processes. So we start off with kind of the key themes for the year when we're setting our goal. We'll agree those at a leadership team. We'll translate them into team goals, and then we will vet those with the wider team. So we have a day or more together where we go through what are the goals for the year ahead, and then every person in the team breaks those down into what that means for them. So they will take those team goals and they'll say, okay, so our goal is to, you know, whatever it might be, increase the number of programs that we run. So my goal, the part that I'm going to play in that is XYZ. So they will work with their line leader to translate that to an individual level. So everyone has a clear line of sight between the thing that they're focusing on for the year and what that means for the business and the business's goals. And I think that's really, really important. You've got to have a line of sight.
No, you do, don't you? You've got to see what the effect is that you're having on a business by whatever it is that you do, even if it's the smallest thing in the entire business. You see that it has that knock-on effect of whatever it is that you're actually doing. I really like that. I think that's really interesting. So you guys, your company has frameworks that you work through in order to make these happen. I mean, like, when people push back against DEI and everything, what is it that you do and teach people in an environment that's not as welcoming, say? What is it that you go forward and say, look, we can help you? Because it's, would you call what you did transformation?
Yeah, so it is ultimately about transformation of organizational cultures and systems. So that generally where we'll start is some kind of, well, we'll generally get called in by either a chief people officer or sometimes a CEO or sometimes someone else on the executive committee. And we'll get called in because they're worried about something. So it might be that they're worried about their culture, or it might be that they're worried about kind of external perception of their lack of progress in this area. There's an increasing shareholder scrutiny, there's customer, consumer scrutiny, employee scrutiny. So we'll get called in. Generally, a starting point is some kind of diagnostic. So we will do it could be a survey of women, it could be a survey of everyone of all genders, men, women, not binary people, to find out what's going on, what are the barriers that they're coming up against. We might do focus groups, we might do a combination of the two. We might also look at their data from their HR system, look at their representation data, any other data they have about recruitment and retention, to see what's going on. Where are women leaving? Where are they falling out of the pipeline? And what are the critical points that need attention? So we will do some kind of diagnostic and play that back. And 9 times out of 10, or in fact, I would say 99 times out of 100, we will find things that the organization wasn't aware of. Because the barriers that are going on for women are usually only ever diagnosed at a fairly superficial surface level. So people will come to us and they'll say, oh, I think we know what's going on. There's not enough role models. And so kind of women, you know, don't have anyone to inspire them, or they're not enough career opportunities.
But yes, that's the one I hear all the time. They get offered more money somewhere else. And you're like, oh.
Yeah. And look, all of that might be true, but it's a symptom. It's not the cause. So when you get to the causes, the root causes, you realize it's because number one cause of leaving intent from our research is that women don't believe bullying and harassment are dealt with appropriately. Or if at all. Another key one is they don't get clear and specific feedback from their immediate line manager on what they need to do to progress. So the role of the line manager is absolutely critical in creating an environment that will either nurture and support or put off women from staying and growing within the organization.
The other thing with this, to drill into this one thing that I've seen again and again, which I find really irritating, is that men will get promoted and the women will get passed over. My clients I'm talking about. And I'll say to my clients, go and ask your boss what you need to do to get to this place. And they're like, oh, but I'm like, no, just go ask them. And then they finally work. It takes us a little while to get there. Then they go and ask their boss what they need in order to get there. And the boss will be like, oh, but they're completely shocked that the woman even is interested, because women are so bad at playing politics in businesses. And Jill Whitty Collins did a whole book on how we don't play politics, apparently, very well. But then you're like, just give me a list. Give me a list and go through that list. And it's so interesting, because then the boss starts to look at you in a completely different way as somebody who's interested in that, as opposed to not interested in just turning up to work every day.
But there is a reason why women don't have those conversations. It's not just lack of negotiation or lack of confidence, which, by the way, is also a myth. It is the fact that women face this double bind. It's the likability penalty, leadership likability penalty. Yeah. So you've got a very narrow range of operating behaviors available to you as a woman. You've got to be confident enough to get on the radar of senior leaders. But if you're too confident, then, oh, she's a bit arrogant, don't you think? You've got to be assertive enough.
Pushy.
Yeah, but then you're too assertive and you're pushy, or you're bossy, or you're domineering, or you're political. So women get a social penalty for operating outside that range, that narrow range of behaviors. So it can be frowned on. Oh, she's too ambitious. She's too this, she's too that. So that's why women are cautious. We are conditioned to be cautious in how we present ourselves.
It's like there's that use, this likability penalty. I love that phrase, because I was looking at this the women who ask for the statistics about how when you ask for, women don't ask for pay rise. And then the minute they negotiate a pay rise, they're a hard ass and they're pushy, and they're negatively perceived, and that follows them through. You know, I have a client who I work with at the moment who is the top performer in her field. Literally the top performer across the entire organization of the London office of a national business. And it has been so interesting putting her quietly into a position where that has visibility while you remain humble enough as a woman to not be hated. And it is a very fine line you know, that you have to operate from.
Yeah. Well, on that negotiation point, the research shows that women are not bad negotiators. Women are just as capable as men at negotiating, but there's a social penalty for doing it. And the way to avoid that is to negotiate on behalf of someone else. So women are expected, society, this comes back to the gender stereotypes I was talking about, societal barriers. Women are expected to be nurturing and kind and care for others. So if you go and negotiate a great deal for your team, then actually that's expected. That's rewarded because women are acting within gender stereotypes. If you negotiate on behalf of yourself, that's seen to contravene gender stereotypes, and that's where the social penalty comes in. So the trick here is to not do it. You've got to negotiate on behalf of yourself, but it's to raise awareness. It's to help educate people in the process, and this is where leaders and HR have a really important role to play to make sure the system recognizes that's okay. If a woman is doing something that a man might do, she shouldn't be penalized for it. Let's have a look at what biases are kicking in when we make those judgments.
How do you raise awareness? Can you go, I can't go sit in front of your boss and go, look, statistically, when women negotiate for a pay rise, apparently it really annoys the hell out of you. So when I do this, I want you to know it's going to annoy you, but actually I really deserve this. And you're like, wow.
Well, coming back to what we do in the transformation, there are five things that we say organizations need to create gender inclusive culture. So number one is you got to know your starting point. That's the diagnostic. You got to know what the problem is in order to be able to solve it. Number two is you need senior leadership buy-in, and you need the work that comes out of this to be aligned with your business strategy. It's got to be in service of the business strategy to get traction. Number three is you've got to get bias out of your processes and systems. So part of this is taking a cold, hard look at recruitment and promotion and salary reviews and performance processes and all the other talent management processes where bias creeps in, and make sure that you're de-biasing the processes. Number four is to engage people. And here's where raising awareness really matters. What you need to do is you need to educate people as to what some of these things are that we all succumb to unconsciously, not deliberately, all these unconscious biases that are playing out around how women negotiate or who's determined or deemed to be bossy or arrogant. You raise awareness so that people can call them out and say, ah, I just had this thought, but actually that's not real, is it? It's just one of those societal biases. So you've got to educate.
Oh my God, it's like riding a frigging bike with square wheels. It really is.
And then the five, just to finish the cycle, the fifth element is we are big believers in leveling the playing field by offering women-specific development programs, because we aren't starting from the same starting point. And so we do believe there is real value to be had in women-only development, whether it's group coaching, whether it's the acceleration programs that we run for women. Getting women together in a cohort is a way of fast-tracking their development.
Yeah, because women have conversations. Like when men are on their own, they have different conversations. Women on their own have different conversations. A bunch of Germans on their own will have German conversations. It's just a thing as opposed to it being about women. Thank you very much. That was fascinating. And it gave me small amounts of hope.
I'm glad to hear that.
Which I wasn't expecting. So yay for the hope. This was the wonderful Sharon Peak, who works with Shape Talent. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Geeta.
And this is Activate Yourself. My name is Geeta Sidhu-Rob. Thank you. I hope you learned something fascinating in that. I certainly did. And check out what they do, because they're really interesting business. And it's, you know, just a lot of the stuff that Sharon puts out in LinkedIn and lots you just learn a lot. And I like the nice, calm way you learn those things when I just want to yell at people. So I'm a big fan. We will speak with you again soon.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for joining us. Our goal was to give you pause, make you think about your life, and inspire you to say, wow, what if I tried to do that? If they can do it, so can I. Did it work? Let us know by finding us on social media at Geeta Sidhu Rob or at Nosh Detox. We upload new shows every 2 weeks here. And if you start to miss us, check us out on YouTube.